This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina's governor has just been handed a set of recommendations on offshore energy options. That report is the result of 2 years of research by a panel that included my guest this hour. Doug Rader is chief ocean scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund, and not only is he a lifelong North Carolinian, his family has roots that go back centuries, he's also someone who is deeply involved in the ecology and the environment and environmental considerations in the state of North Carolina. Doug Rader, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Well, we are fans of your work, though we may not all be aware of the kind of work and the kind of study you've done in this state. And hopefully we'll come to understand that better in this hour. You grew up in Charlotte. How did you come to love the ecology and the environment of the state?
I did grow up in Charlotte, although my roots are in the foothills, the forest fields and hollers of the Blue Ridge Mountains, where my most recent immigrant ancestor, I mean immigrant to North Carolina, arrived in the 1790s. I like to joke that all the rest of them were busy inbreeding at that time, and it's basically the case. But the truth is that my mother was a daughter of the hills and made sure that my two brothers and I were out there all the time, whether it was wading the creeks, catching snakes or hunting frogs or attending Boy Scouts. I was an active and fervent Boy Scout for many years with Troop 47, Grace Methodist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. Paul Hodge, who was a scoutmaster, actually made sure that every single month of every single year we were out there camping and interacting with the environment. And then my parents took us camping at the beach every single year for weeks at a time. My dad would drop us off. We'd spend a week or two with my mom, and then he'd come back and get us, meaning that we had weeks to ramble the Carolina coast, the dunes and beaches at dawn and after dusk, seining the swashes and wondering at the grab bag of things that come up in a net that together constitute the wonder that's North Carolina.
That kind of unleashed exploration leads to a kind of natural sense of ecology, the relationship among things. You catch on pretty quick, don't you?
Sure, a sense of place. In real estate, we talk about location, 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 and it's even more so in the natural world, and I argue also in the human world where nature and people come together. Since the landscapes shape the living things that are there, the living things shape the resources that are available for people to use, that in turn shape society and cultures, and have since North Carolina began to be colonized in the late 17th century.
So we've all had that experience, or a lot of us have, of kind of roaming some kind of wilderness, being excited about it, especially the finds. You know, you find this kind of animal in that sort of pool, but not when the sun is shining. And all these connections start in your little 8-year-old mind. When did you decide that this might be a career for you?
I guess I always assumed that it would be, and yet my mother actually knew I was going to be a scientist, but thought I should be a doctor, although the sight of blood never did much for me. And maybe it was the garter snake she put in my Christmas stocking when I was 8. I'm not sure. But
your mother did that?
She did. Uh-huh. Maybe it was picking up the box turtles beside the road, whether it was at a battlefield in Petersburg, North Carolina, or Virginia, or down to the Carolina coast, so that it wouldn't be squished by oncoming traffic. But I don't know. I was taught that way. In fact, my maternal grandfather, was an itinerant teacher who moved around the foothills of the mountains teaching other people. But he also was a horticulturalist, and he grew all kinds of fantastic plants and other things. And then during the Depression, they also harvested ginseng and other botanicals in order to get the butter and egg money they needed to supplement the things that they could make on their farm. So it's just been a part of me, Frank, as far as I remember. So when I went off to school at UNC, it was clear I was going to be a biologist. And ecology, the question of how things fit together, living things, exploit landscapes and each other, and then how people interact with those was clearly the way that I wanted to go with my life.
And you started at the kind of tiny, tiny wormy level, didn't you?
I did. My technical work, my technical training for both my master's degree, well, frankly, my bachelor's degree from the University of North Carolina, my master's degree from the University of Washington, and then my doctoral degree back to the University of North Carolina, were all focused on little spineless critters, things that people would always ignore if you saw them.
So political science? I'm sorry. Chief Shot couldn't. I'm sorry.
I set that one up, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Thanks.
Yeah, but I knew that when I finished my dissertation, having counted bazillions of little rose Bengal bright purple stained worms, that I needed to commit my life to something more than that. I knew I didn't understand much at all about the way that our fabulous natural resources are managed. And so on purpose, but also to feed the family, worked for the Division of Coastal Management, the Division of Environmental Management that at that time was running water quality issues in North Carolina. And then I was the first director of the Albemarle Pamlico National Estuary Program in its formative days up through about 1988. At that time, Environmental Defense Fund, which I had never heard of, to tell you the honest truth, now opened its office here in the southeast with the leadership of Steve Levitas. He asked me to have lunch with him and identify candidates for his senior scientist position. I got seriously interested in the idea of doing hardcore, cutting-edge science, but in the name of advocacy and our children's future, and took that job and have been with EDF ever since 1988.
Well, I want to get back to the invertebrate period of your life because you were somebody who obviously had a big picture and a sense of it all in a kind of heartfelt, you know, spiritual way and in a very tactile way. And then you get into the minutiae of these little worms. Was it something, I mean, were you always sort of being pulled out to the macro picture, or do you become immersed in that and then look back and say, you know, each of those details and elements now?
I guess I've always wondered how things work, and understanding how things work requires you to get those details right. So, and it turns out that so many of the unseen things in our world shape its power and integrity. A quick example, if you want to go fishing off the North Carolina coast and catch a certain set of snappers and groupers and other things, it's very likely the case that those animals weren't spawned here in the first place, and that the larval and the juvenile fishes that drifted here with the currents took a very long ride indeed, up to 6 weeks or 8 weeks or longer, and covering hundreds if not thousands of miles along the way, all out of sight, all out of mind, but creating the reality, the larger scale visual reality that a fisherman in a boat in North Carolina sees. And that's the case across the board, where unseen processes operating at every scale, from the very tiniest to the very largest, all knit together to form the reality of the place where we live and the place that we love so dearly.
It's with that kind of vision that you then become a part of the environmental infrastructure here. You began working for the state in the late 1980s, and you got thrown into the middle of this sort of ecological struggle over the Pamlico River. And maybe you can remind us.
Yeah, that's right. I think some people may remember the fish kills in the Noose during the 90s, but the decade before, in the middle to late 80s, the Pamlico River was actually declared commercially dead by the North Carolina Marine Fisheries Director, Bill Hogarth, who later would become the National Marine Fisheries Director. And the cause of that was excessive nutrients, especially nitrogen, running off from fields and farms and also through pipes from factories and sewer plants, all adding up together down in this estuary that turned out to be one of the nation's most important in terms of producing baby fish for the entire East Coast of the United States. Too much of a good thing is a very easy bottom line way to think about it. So I actually wrote the state's first report on the Pamlico River and potential solutions thereby. And then after making the transition to EDF back in February of 1988, started working immediately, and not just with the resource managers and regulators, but also with the stakeholders, with Texas Gulf, that was at that time the biggest nutrient producer in the entire Pamlico River, but also the sewer plants and farmers, to be able to figure out an approach that would work for everybody, both because it got the job done in the water for the fish, but also for people's pocketbooks. I'm really very proud of the direct work that we did with Texas Gulf to take what was at that time the world's largest phosphate mine and fertilizer manufacturing facility and completely retrofit it in terms of water management and nutrient management to cut phosphorus delivery into the cooking part of the Pamlico, the problem part of that river, by more than 90%, and then other pollutants by even more.
Well, and all the more impressive because that was back at a time when this was considered an either-or proposition. It's either the environment or the economy. You can't have both, and somehow you managed to find a compromise.
Yeah, and I would just say that is always a false dichotomy, that a working environment, a healthy working environment, is foundational for economic well-being for North Carolina. And that's not just the case today based on the fact that tourism is our number one economic generator, but more fundamentally because so many of the processes that we take for granted, whether it's availability of fresh water or for that matter water into which discharges are allowable, but also the happiness and health of the people we need to as employees and as the shapers of future generations of business, all love and depend upon those healthy environments. So getting it right requires it to be right from both perspectives.
We will talk about the politics of getting it right and the choices we face as we continue our conversation this hour with Doug Rader, Chief Ocean Scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund. When we come back, talk about the governor's scientific advisory panel and what advice it has come up with for offshore energy. We're going to do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour is Doug Rader, Chief Ocean Scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund, also a member of the Governor's Scientific Advisory Panel on Offshore Energy. And that panel has just finished its work. In fact, it wrapped it up yesterday. And its recommendations have been handed over to the governor in the form of a report that Doug co-authored. So, in fact, before we get into the recommendations, tell us about the offshore energy options for North Carolina.
Okay. So North Carolina is blessed with a wide array of energy options in the offshore waters that are really impressive and interesting. There's been a lot of focus on oil and gas, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But I think one of the main messages coming from this report, but also from previous analysis done by the combined universities in North Carolina, is that the potential for significant amounts of energy from wind is simply unexcelled. Just to be clear, the North Carolina has by far the greatest wind potential of any state on the East Coast, and should that wind potential be fully exerted, it could provide up to 130% of North Carolina's foreseeable wind needs for the long term.
Wind needs or energy? Total energy needs.
Sorry, total energy needs. Wind could provide up to 130% of North Carolina's total energy needs for the foreseeable future.
So tell us how this works. What's the technology? How would you harvest this energy, and kind of what would it look like?
I think everyone's familiar with windmills. In fact, people, many citizens have lost touch with the fact that our history back in the 18th century incorporated windmills all over the coast of North Carolina to provide motive power of different types. But this is a few generations beyond that, where high, tall, several meter, 100 meter tall towers with large turbines are propelled by the very large wind resource that exists where the cold water currents from the north and the warm water currents from the south meet and spawn storms of all types. And it creates a mosaic in which winds are not 100% constant, but constant. So we're looking at large farms or mosaics of large windmills far offshore. If one looks at the area beyond the horizon out to depths that are reasonable, and that means about 40 fathoms or 240 feet, then there's ample space, roughly 500 or so 9 by 9 nautical mile blocks, the way the federal regulators look at it, enough space to provide 50,000 megawatts, that's 50 gigawatts, of prospective power. And even if you discount that for inefficiencies or the time when the winds aren't blowing, that still gets you 20 to 25 gigawatts of actual delivered power in those offshore waters.
And you said beyond the horizon, so these things are out of sight. They're not on the beaches.
That's right. Out of sight completely. So in the middle level depths where the resource is actually greatest offshore before it gets reduced by interacting with the coast itself. So that's a tremendous amount of power and a tremendous opportunity. Now, as with any other startup, there are significant challenges in public policy and putting together the resources that are necessary to be able to jumpstart an industry like that and then in building it out.
Well, how much would it cost to create that from where we are right now?
You know, I don't think I can give you the right number, Frank. A lot. Of course, it doesn't go that way. None of these things do. They all start small and put in place pilot projects. And you probably heard that for a while Duke Power was considering a pilot project in the inshore waters of Pamlico Sound. And in fact, cost was part of the problem that delayed that project because it was scaled at the 5-megawatt scale mm-hmm. only and would have cost a lot per megawatt to be able to do that.
Of course, one person's cost is another person's industry. When you talk about cost, you're talking about putting people to work creating that energy.
And there also are externalities, including emissions associated with traditional burning of coal or fuel oil that end up generating carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that right now are free or external to the perceived cost of those technologies, but in the not-too-distant future will probably be monetized and will be costs on the ledger. So I think it's important as we go forward talking about all of these things to think about the full exerted cost of the technologies, not just in short-term monetary costs, but in human costs and environmental costs that then also have to be taken into account. So in addition to wind, what we found was that some of the other kinds of so-called green technologies that people know about from the ocean may never be very efficient here. The things that turn and bump and go up and down, the scientists call hydrokinetics, that are so important on the West Coast, so important potentially to Florida, where a good bit of the Florida current could be harvested and provide gigawatts of power to Florida. Those things we believe may be important, but only on the margins. There are two other things that are kind of interesting, though. One is a new but old technology called ocean thermal energy conversion, where the difference in temperature between warm surface waters and cold, very deep waters can be used to make power. The short version of the way it works is that the warm waters can be used to evaporate a working fluid like ammonia that then exerts a vapor pressure and turns a turbine mm-hmm. and then can be recondensed with the cold waters and around it goes. That technology was limited in the 70s because of the efficiency of heat exchangers, but brand new work by Lockheed Martin and by the Japanese and other people around the world is bringing that technology back in the forefront. So we believe that in the not in the immediate future, but down the road, and especially as infrastructure is built to let power acquisition get out into the offshore waters, that it may be possible to combine ocean thermal energy conversion with wind power and actually deliver significant amounts of additional power to North Carolina.
Let me just stop you right there because you mentioned those two, thermal energy and wind power, and it sounded to me like North Carolina is very well suited. In fact, in the case of wind, probably best situated to harvest those things. Why? What is it about this place that makes those two technologies so?
So the plus on wind is pretty obvious, and it comes from three things. Number one, the length of the shoreline. We have a tremendously long shoreline. Number two, the width of the continental shelf, meaning depths that are required to install wind facilities. Now, they don't actually have to be anchored to the bottom, but some of the floating technologies are farther out into the future. So we, in these studies, that opportunity has actually been sort of deferred for now. But the third factor is that these cold and warm water currents we talked about earlier come together here and keep the wind blowing. Remember that that wind comes from differences in surface temperatures on the surface of the sea or the surface of the land. And so it's those differences that keep the wind blowing. So the fact that we happen to exist where cold water northerly currents and warm water currents from the south collide is the third factor that brings our own perfect storm for wind. So that's a very important resource not to be diminished. The last one I'll just mention in passing is a very frontier kind of thing called methane hydrates, where basically frozen natural gas exists in deep layers in the very deep waters off North Carolina, and some people think that the Bermuda Triangle legends come in part from burps of seafloor methane coming up, changing the density of seawater and swallowing ships whole. But the resource is out there. Should a safe harvesting method become available at some time in the future, that's an additional piece.
Well, we talked about and all of these sound like relatively low-impact, environmentally friendly ways of harvesting energy, but they do have an impact. There's no way on Earth that you can harvest, that you can build something out in a place without affecting the environment, without affecting the ecology, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, that inherent trade-off in costs and benefits was the major conclusion. Actually, it's a major conclusion of this report. It's also a major conclusion of the preceding report when Dr. Jim Lutze and I co-chaired the Legislative Subcommittee on Offshore Energy Exploration, where we determined that exact accounting of pluses and minuses on the energy equation, but also on the environmental, social, and economic equations must be accounted in order for these trade-offs to be understood well enough so that people and their elected representatives can make the right choices for North Carolina. It turns out that the choices are more complicated than it seems. A lot of people believe that the oil and gas resource that is offshore in North Carolina, and just for clarity, that resource is badly known. There are no new data about it. The information that's available is more than 30 years old. The best guess from the feds is that there would be probably about a 26-day supply of liquid petroleum products at the rate that the United States uses those, and about a 240-day supply of natural gas should that amount actually be discovered. Now, there's a big asterisk there, and that is that no one really knows.
Well, let me stop you there and ask, would you recommend, did this panel recommend, that there be more exploration to get a better answer, a better idea about what's out there in terms of oil and natural gas?
The panel operated under consensus, and we were able to generate a consensus on just about everything, not every single thing. One of the places where we, I'm not going to say disagree, but have a variety of viewpoints, is on that issue of exploration. Under the status quo approach that the U.S. government uses, we lease areas. We permit scientific research that would look for oil and gas resources, but that information then becomes proprietary. And while some government agencies have access to some part of that, it doesn't actually fuel the large-scale public knowledge that would be necessary to be able to plan for how much energy might be there. In other words, you find out whether or not a particular place that a particular company is interested in may be more or less likely to have something. And that really doesn't help very much with the broader-scale problem of knowing more about how much we have. So the panel agreed that we need to know more about what North Carolina and adjacent states might have in order to best protect North Carolina's interests including the environment that sustains the economy. But that process is going to be challenging because of the status quo.
If we found out that there were lots and lots of oil and natural gas offshore, given the other options and the amount of energy that that the panel suggests could be generated, would it make sense? Is it part of the package of energy options?
So the panel absolutely believes so. We left in here a wide array of recommendations about oil and gas and how North Carolina ought to proceed, both to understand more about what might and might not be there. And I just should say as an aside that there is some indication, and this is mostly based on the technical views of Dr. Stan Riggs, formerly with East Carolina University, I think a world-class treasure for North Carolina. I'm delighted he's on our side generally, that there could be a big find out there. I mean, it's possible. There have been big finds in some other places that are geologically more or less like this. So that is a possibility. Although, as a second aside, North Carolinians need to remember that even should such a find occur, it wouldn't likely affect the price of the pump here, that find would be important in terms of domestic energy security, maybe, although it really goes into the global maw for liquid petroleum products. The panel believes that it might be important because the leasing arrangements and royalty arrangements that exist in the offshore waters where, well, right now there are none for the Atlantic coast, but should the Gulf of Mexico type financial system be imported to North Carolina waters, it could create a flow of cash into the North Carolina General Fund that could be an important asset for the people, but also be used to offset negative impacts on the environment and also on coastal communities. But right at this point, that's all speculative because, number one, the revenue sharing protocols don't exist for North Carolina. That requires congressional action. And then, number two, we just don't know what's there.
And what about jobs?
Yes. So right. And so there's a potential for new energy industries, and I'll just say it that way, all of them, to support badly needed jobs in coastal North Carolina. And while in every case certain high-level jobs would be required to be filled by people who are technically trained in those fields, whether it is repairing the offshore windmills or doing the detailed cementing jobs around deep boreholes, either of those have the potential to enhance jobs directly and indirectly by feeding revenues into the North Carolina economy. The trick is going to be in balancing these things because in the same way that there are those positives, there also are potential threats. Obviously, in the case of oil, should something like the Deepwater Horizon event happen, then one of America's true natural treasures would be very much at risk. And I should state that carefully because North Carolina is, though we all love it because it's North Carolina, it's important because of what and where it is. Location, location, location again. So many life histories, so many natural histories of important animals are from the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia to the Gulf of Mexico in terms of fish, from the Arctic tundras down to the tropical rainforest in terms of migratory birds, all are tied to the health of what happens here. So we are stewards and have a very strong need to protect those areas.
And when we think about jobs too, I guess we think about refining oil and all of those, the potential jobs. What about those jobs?
So I mentioned scenarios before and the fact that the General Assembly's panel felt like understanding the most likely scenarios would be key to understanding the most likely impacts of investing in any one of these technologies for North Carolina. And that's especially the case with oil and gas, since people have been assuming that a find here would drive an industry similar to the Gulf Coast in terms of, you know, cracking towers and refineries and all that kind of stuff. And it's not at all clear that that would be the most likely scenario. In fact, there is abundant unused refinery capacity in Williamsburg, Virginia, and other places that very likely would be served instead. And in fact, it might be the case that no either liquid or gas would come ashore in North Carolina. It just depends on the entire energy mosaic and infrastructure on the U.S. East Coast.
When you made your recommendation, certainly there is science, and we know that we argue over science and that politics plays a very important part in interpreting the research. Did you have to take that into account as a panel when you made your recommendations?
We actually tried not to this time. The panel was composed of 15 people under the chairmanship of Willis Wichard, and he insisted from the beginning, and I think we were able to achieve operation by consensus where we possibly could, where we could get to the bottom of things and figure out the truth to the extent that there is a truth or a set of competing perspectives and positions and information and try to thread that needle that way. So the vast preponderance of what you see in the report and in the wording and the findings of fact and the factual material that's presented in, it's a long document, it's over 100 pages somewhere, is all consensus information. And that's from a group with a very diverse set of membership from people with vast experience and representative of the oil industry, and for that matter, the wind industry, and then all the way up to eminent scientists like Dr. Pete Peterson and Dr. Stan Riggs. And actually, I'm in trouble if I start naming people because these are all incredibly important people for North Carolina. But we actually operated under consensus 99% of the time, and there's only a few things where we basically voted language up or down.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a break right here, and when we come back, we'll find out what some of those policy recommendations are and whether or not there's a particular policy path in the report that's just been completed on its way to the governor's office, perhaps in her hands even as we speak. My guest this hour, Doug Rader, Chief Ocean Scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Doug Rader, Chief Ocean Scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund, co-author of a new report to the governor on offshore energy. And Doug, I want to find out what those recommendations were. Tell us again, remind us who was on this panel.
So, Frank, the panel in its 2 years of work, as I said, was chaired by Willis Wichard, but included representatives of just about every possible stakeholder faction, but including scientists and scholars, energy industry representatives from most possible energy technologies, including people with technical backgrounds to be able to answer questions in that regard, representative of coastal communities, representative of non-governmental organizations, just about the whole package.
All right. You were at it for 2 years. What should we do?
I think the most important recommendation from the panel is that North Carolina should get off its duff and prepare for an energy future, including the offshore waters, because it's nearly certain that North Carolina's offshore waters will not simply be left to the fish and fishermen, as much as some people might like that, and that there are important things that need doing in order to make that happen so that the costs and benefits, the pluses and minuses, whether they're environmental, economic, or social that we talked about earlier can be better enumerated according to the most likely scenarios so the choices can be made. And in fact, the panel specifically recommends the establishment of an offshore energy center in North Carolina to take advantage of the abundant university resources that we have already, many of whom are already involved in this set of questions in one way or another. But to put those pieces together in a coherent and discrete form so that there is a real way for North Carolina to make some choices here that make sense to guide this transition that we all know is coming. And there's a lot of specifics related to how that might happen and the choices that need to be made. But that's number one. Then with respect to each of the technologies on wind, the panel strongly endorses the development of that very large prospective wind resource that we talked about before and believes that important investments need to be made by the state of North Carolina and the federal government and its people in order to begin planning to exploit that resource.
That sounds like, again, this is an industry where there is not an awful lot of infrastructure, unlike the oil industry, which may already, and with its underused capacity, you find the oil, it could go to Virginia to be processed. Here are industries which potentially could create all kinds of jobs in the state of North Carolina if we could figure out quickly how to get this done.
Right? Sure, that's exactly right. And if your listeners want the chapter and verse, that absolutely excellent UNC Wind study really lays it out in great detail and is not hard to find through any internet search engine. If you just Google UNC Wind study, you'll find fabulous figures that lay out the pluses and minuses, the areas to be avoided, where the resource is, and how it could be translated into into power for North Carolina. But in addition, there are a variety of small companies that are really interested in doing this now, and then a set of federal processes through which leasing for alternative energy, including wind development, can be pursued. And in fact, the federal architecture right now has constituted a wind energy task force that is meeting right now to look at how that ought to go forward. So that's the most important recommendation related to wind. When you go to oil and gas, it's really clear that North Carolina needs to know more before we leap in willy-nilly in chasing the oil and gas rabbit. Many of the specific information needs were laid out back in the early 90s after the Mobile Drilling Task Force, which I also served on for the governor at that time. Not all of those key questions have yet been answered. So among a whole lot of other things, we recommended that all of the studies called for by that North Carolina Environmental Sciences Review Panel back in the 1990s ought to be completed, so that the likelihood of impact of different kinds of impacts from the leasing of offshore oil and gas lands that are coming forward can go forward in an informed way. In addition to that, Governor Perdue has made a decision to, though our panel has gone out of business, to reconstitute the scientific advisory panel to pursue the recommendations that the legislative panel and our panel put together, but also to add a discussion of other energy opportunities to the mix, including hydraulic fracturing or so-called fracking of Triassic shales in the Piedmont in North Carolina.
Well, let me stop you there for just a second since you raised it. Have you studied that much, and what's your sense of the cost and benefits of that?
So I'm not going to pretend to be an expert there. We do have experts at Environmental Defense Fund nationally on the big picture and in North Carolina on the implications for North Carolina. My personal opinion is that it's really only that there are pluses and minuses associated with each of these things, including fracking, and that we need to know more before jumping in with both feet in fracking, and particularly in terms of risks to groundwater that are so important to people who live in those areas. And then there remain questions about how much methane as a greenhouse gas is released associated with fracking, and more importantly, what kinds of practices are available to minimize those releases. Most people forget that methane is a greenhouse gas 30 times as powerful as carbon dioxide when it comes to driving global warming. So that management of methane associated with fracking also has to be carefully considered. So there's a whole bunch of issues like that, and mostly I get to defer to those other experts and to the follow-on panel to get that right. Another specific recommendation related to oil and gas is that the lessons of the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf be fully realized, and that much better planning and environmental review and response capacity be developed, so that if a large-scale oil and gas industry is ever built in the Southeast, whether it's here or in adjacent waters where oil would come to our shores, whether north or south. Remember, the currents come together here, so we get everybody's oil, that those response mechanisms would be in place to prevent the kinds of problems that we saw happening there. In terms of the other opportunities, we frankly believe that, as I mentioned earlier, the hydrokinetic technologies will probably never be more than a small-scale piece in North Carolina.
So hydrokinetic is just the moving water, currents just flowing back and forth.
These are currents, yeah. Currents turning turbine, mm-hmm. turning turbine blades, or rising or falling tides, moving mm-hmm. things up and down in the water. There's actually more than 50 technologies that have been developed in this general array of so-called hydrokinetic approaches that can be very valuable in other places and are probably not well suited to North Carolina. And then in the longer run, we believe that the right combination of approaches to ocean thermal energy conversion, and including the potential for 100-megawatt floating energy ships, which sounds like a science fiction possibility, but would be necessary in North Carolina because of the vagaries of where the warm water currents come and go off North Carolina, might be a part of the mosaic. The very bottom line on all of this is that every single thing has pluses and minuses that need to be better understood before we jump in with both feet, as I said before. That said, there's very important potential in a variety of ways if it's managed properly.
So getting started is something we shouldn't drag our feet on, but picking a technology right away or going headlong is probably something we should wait till we have better information.
I think that's the way most people would put it. There's one other opportunity, and that is that states that are looking on the Atlantic to do a little bit of offshore oil and gas sampling may well be farther along than we are, and Virginia comes to mind particularly. And so it may well be that we can get better information as the overall Atlantic coast-wide process moves forward and use that in terms of planning for North Carolina.
Your sense of consensus building and bringing all parties to the table may have been formed by an experience you had very early in your career dealing with the Pamlico and your meeting a guy named Willie Phillips.
Yeah, Willie Phillips is a personal hero of mine. I first met Willie when I was a state official. I was the hearing officer for a set of regulations that had been designed by the state to manage what was then the environmental boogeyman, and that was the prospect of mining peat. Peat is organic soil laid down over tens of thousands of years, and in many places in eastern North Carolina can be up to 10 or 12 or 15 or even 20 feet thick, and could, like coal, be burned to make power. And there were, in fact, proposals on the table to build major power plants and mine out the peat, creating large lakes. Willie is a fisherman. At that time was working on the Pamlico River, was very concerned about the potential for delivering mercury and other pollutants into the Pamlico that we talked about earlier. At that time was already in big trouble. This is in the middle 80s. And was worried that the state of North Carolina would take a middle road and would allow mining to occur that would destroy his particular golden goose in North Carolina, but also the key nurseries of that region. He showed up at the hearing, and it was in Swan Quarter in Hoyt County, North Carolina. It was me and about maybe 600 or 700 mostly angry citizens who were worried about their natural resources. Willie was straight off the boat. He had his waders on. He brought a tub of diseased fish and slapped it down on the table, and pointed to the sores in the fish and said, "What are you going to do about this?" What I found in talking to him afterwards and later and coming to understand his concerns and wishes was that it was possible to build regulations that would work. I actually believe that those peat mining regulations now would allow peat mining to occur in a way that was also protective of the downshore waters. That model of working with affected people became a foundation of my career at the state and now at Environmental Defense Fund. I'm very proud of the time that we have spent working with Texas Gulf. I told you about that before. Also with Weyerhaeuser, we negotiated a win-win in the old East Dismal Swamp that protected the last remnants of that swamp, but also put in place a set of water management processes and forestry management processes that will protect both the swamp and the needs of the companies to harvest trees there. And that approach is what works best for fisheries, too.
Well, it certainly helped the Pamlico. We should talk about it. I mean, that's a success story.
Sure, absolutely. The massive fish kills, the algal blooms, the dead water events that plagued the region all through the 80s are largely a thing of the past. Now, Hurricane Irene was responsible for dumping a fair amount of material in there, and there are some additional threats as the population in the Piedmont and the headwaters of the Neuse and the Pamlico continues to grow. But for now, the very egregious environmental catastrophes that were underway at the time are largely a thing of the past.
Is that kind of consensus building still possible now in this climate? It doesn't feel like that sort of conversation even happens anymore.
Well, I think it will have to. There is political mileage on the far ends of the spectrum, but the solutions are still being built in the middle and still require an understanding of what it is that people need in order to design solutions that actually work. And that's going to be a hallmark going forward of persistent environmental solutions.
Yeah, but there's a growing sense, or at least there's some growing ever louder rhetoric that the government should have no part in this, that they're just a big intrusion, that they cost us a lot of money, and government regulation is the problem. Let's get rid of it.
So what I found is that people care deeply about the environment for a lot of reasons. Some are religion, some aesthetic, some personal and practical. The environmental, the recreational resources that people love and care about, and particularly for their children, and that when solutions are crafted, that people are willing to give a bit to get more, and that's where things are going to work. The top-down drivers or goals being set from the top that are cross-cutting shared values, but solution design from the bottom up. So whether it's the design of a nutrient trading program in the Tar Pamlico or a modern-day catch share in fisheries where fishermen are allowed more flexibility in managing their proportional share of a fishery that grows in size as a fish population grows in abundance, and where all the command and control scenarios, the bag limits and size limits and open seasons and open areas and closed areas and all the things that makes fishing impossible are allowed to go away because performance in terms of goals is better. Whether you look at it any of those ways, those are the solutions that work.
So you finished this report, wrapped up last night. It's on its way to the governor. What's your next project?
Oh, that's great. And just for clarity, this is my third time around on energy, right, between the Governor Martin back in 89. And I think there is enough for an additional generation to do here. But my big challenge right now is putting the pieces together for a healthy coastal ecosystems. And you can think about the coast of North Carolina as a three-legged stool with healthy fish, good water quality, and healthy habitats, all three being required to keep the stool upright. So though we have worked on all three stools historically, right now we're focusing like a laser on getting the fishing part of the equation right, both commercial and recreational fishing, and are working on that all over the country, but with a strong emphasis on the southeastern United States.
Doug, what a pleasure. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank. It's been a delight.
Doug Rader is Chief Ocean Scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. You can learn more about that at edf.org. That's the State of Things for today. You can learn about us at stateofthings.org and find us on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix, Alex Granados, Isaac Davey Aronson. Jenny Mueller is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.